Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Dan and Bod Smile Time Happy Hour, brought to you by the producers of The Echo Chamber. Hello and welcome again to The Echo Chamber. And I say again on purpose because we have our very first returning guest to the show. Ooh. And Dr. Danny Goyle. Honestly, Dan, I loved our chat the first time we had the chat, and it's mostly about you. But I've loved the chat. I've loved watching everything that's been happening. And of course, if people don't know, we met two prime ministers ago, didn't we? at least...
Was that about 8 weeks ago?
Actually, yeah. I mean, at this rate, we could have been 3 or 4 prime ministers ago. It was so long ago we chatted.
Oh my God, unbelievable. What has happened since, man? It's crazy. It wasn't even a year ago, was it? I don't even think it was a year ago.
I'm not even sure it was a year. No. Oh my goodness. And the thing is, right, so much has happened since. It's almost difficult to know where to start. How have you been anyway since we last talked?
Yeah, I've been all right. I mean, I think work did catch up on me a fair bit. We suffered like everyone, the big staff shortages, and I think I was carrying a bit of a heavy weight, and I think it did kind of catch up on me actually, and I had to take some downtime and recoup, and which I did. So and other than that, you know, family and paying the bills that just keep seeming to increase every time I look at them. So, but yeah, other than that, not too bad. What about you, Farbod? Tell me.
Not too bad. Well, I think it's much the same, really, isn't it? Work has been very difficult, unrelenting. So you kind of try and see if there's stuff outside of work that you can try and occupy yourself with and allow yourself some decompression. But yeah, I have been enjoying, and part of the reason I've brought you back to the show is because I have really enjoyed what's been happening politically in a really like horrible masochistic way. I've really enjoyed what's been happening politically.
Humor way. Did you see that break? That was so cool. Oh my God, there was a bone sticking out. I know.
We're such terrible. But I've always had this thing, like if you don't see the absurdity in these situations, and I think it is a medic thing, you're right. Mm-hmm. If we don't see, that's what leads to our dark humour. Because if you can't see the absurdity of it all,
you go crazy.
Then it will make you go insane. If you absolutely make you go insane, you will be lost to it. You have to laugh, because if you didn't laugh, you would cry, and there's not enough tears in the world.
Yeah, man, totally.
Exactly.
And as an
exactly. It's entirely a coping mechanism.
Proper. And for you, Farbod, A&E consultant at this time, it has to be one of the most sporting times to be an A&E consultant, you know.
I know, man. I've never known a time like it. And I know we talked, what was it, a good year and a half into the pandemic response, and a lot of our chat was around what had happened in that time. But what is happening in the emergency departments now is on a level which is, what can you say about it that hasn't already been said? I remember the college came out with a statistic, and I'm going to get some of the dates and the numbers wrong, but this is roughly what it was. They came out, I think it was in March time this year, and basically they said in the preceding 6 months, from October until March, we had had some 60,000, so around that mark, I can't remember, 60,000 12-hour breaches in emergency departments across the UK. And to put that into context, in the previous 11 years, prior to that six-month period, we had had just over 50,000.
Incredible.
So, like, just looking at that stat, you can see how what an incredible pressure there is on these departments. But it can't even, you know, you can't even get your head around it. We know that that essentially leads to approximately 1% of 12-hour breaches lead to an excess death.
It's just, and then the data has shown that excess deaths in England continue to be high and run high, and Wales, but not in Scotland. So Scotland's excess deaths are actually almost exclusively COVID, and you know, we were definitely at a much lower percentage. And it's interesting because in England, you guys are running at about 95% capacity at the moment, which is just bonkers before Christmas. I mean, I've never heard of that before Christmas and before winter. And in Scotland, we're 85%, and we do have more doctors, we have more nurses, and it's crazy here. I mean, it's absolutely, trying to find a bed, I mean, is like, you know, and every morning it's the same chat, you know, free up beds, and you're like, well, I can't, you know, make the person better any faster than we're doing, you know. But I tell you one thing that gets me, Farbod, is the thing that I've noticed more and more as time's gone by since the last time we spoke is the morale. I mean, I find that I just feel that it's like the air's been let out, and everyone's just kind of autopilot, and they don't, it just feels like no one's got anything else to give. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which in a service that runs,
I know exactly what you mean.
That runs on goodwill. The whole thing that, you know, it's always running us doing more. I think that's I think that's gonna that for me might indicate that it's broke. And I'm not sure what they can do to fix that morale issue. Do you know what I mean? So I that's my worry. I think we might recover the services, but I'm not sure. I don't know how we can recover the morale, if I'm honest.
I wish there was... I wish I could offer some succor to that.
I'm looking to you, man. Man, that's why I was asking the question.
Okay. All right, let me readjust my seat and come up with something. Well, do you know what? I'll tell you what one thing they could do, just a basic thing. They could stop cutting pay. Just stop cutting pay. Not even like give us more money. Just increase pay at the rate of inflation.
Yeah.
That's like the bare minimum you could do to just let's just start somewhere. You know, you know, they say that the journey of 1,000 miles starts with a single step. That's a single step.
It's not a huge amount. Just that. Farbod. It's not a huge amount. I mean, geez.
It's not a huge amount, but except it's we've reached a point in public services in this country. We've got barristers striking. When have you ever heard the barristers striking? What is going on?
And I think there's even
consultants standing around in their £1,000 wigs, singing red, you know, singing the red flag. You know, all these barristers outside the Old Bailey.
But you know, there's a thing that like gets me a wee bit with that, because we're all going to strike, right? We're all one by one. We're all going to strike. They're just, I think, should be grateful we're not all striking at once. But the government loses, and the NHS executives lose the power of giving us all a boost by just going, you know what, it's really hard just now, we get why you're leaving, we get your pay's been cut, we value you here, pay restoration, it's done, you know, whatever restrictions they want to put on it for everyone under 45k or everyone under 30k, whatever restrictions they want to put on it, but if they came out and said that, then suddenly everyone's uplifted and go, okay, maybe they do care. Maybe they do value us. Maybe the shoddy PPE they put us in and maybe thrown us to the wolves when they let COVID rip last Christmas. And, you know, maybe they do actually care about us and maybe, you know, we feel a bit better about things. Instead, what they're going to make us do, they're going to make us fight for it. And they're going to make us drag the money out of them and say, well, you know, I just think they're just losing that whole opportunity just to go, we value, here you go, everyone get a boost, and then people stop leaving the service. Because at the end of the day, striking is much better than them leaving, which is what's happening just now. But they're not going to capitalize on it. I don't think they're going to capitalize on it. Cause,
no. Tell us about what's happening in Scotland.
Scotland, they did a bit better. I mean, so basically the lowest earners got in the NHS got an 11% pay rise, which was inflation met just above, slightly above
matching.
Inflation. So we're not poorer, basically. That's all they've done is stopped us from being poorer for working at the hardest time in the NHS's history. But the rest of us, I think is all about, it's about an 8% they offered across the board, but 11% for the lowest earners, which I thought was pretty decent. I thought it was at least something. And they are putting a lot more money into trying to rescue it this winter, but it's not enough.
It's not enough, and there is that feeling, isn't there? Very much, I think, that it's now too little, too late. And I think that morale thing you brought up earlier is that resignation, I think, that people feel within themselves, that actually there is no, the fuse is lit, and there is no way of stopping it now, and it's just a matter of time. And everyone has a moment in which they are kind of, there's probably a line in the sand in the souls of all of these people that work in the NHS, but across all the public sector as well. Once it reaches that point, they're just going to down tools and, you know what, they don't care anymore. Like you said, the whole service runs on the goodwill of so many people. Yeah. And the goodwill is not a bottomless well. There is very much a finite amount of it out there, and for each person it's different, and we are the well is running dry for so many people over the last 2 years, but it doesn't seem to be there doesn't seem to be the political will to kind of get in the way. And like we said, we have had in the last 6 years since something that happened in 2016, I can't remember what it was, but something happened in 2016, and since 2016, we have had 5 prime ministers. And the previous 5 prime ministers came in the previous 37 years to 2016. So I don't know what it was about 2016 that kind of accelerated... accelerated this turnover of prime ministers. And you know, if you go back to that before 2016 period and said, oh, do you know what, in the next 6 years you're gonna have 5 prime ministers, people would go, no we won't. That's the kind of thing that happens in a unstable state that has no functioning legislature.
You couldn't pitch that to Netflix, right? You couldn't say, this is my idea. We're going to have all these prime ministers. We're going to have this like flamboyant guy who's totally lying and doing dodgy stuff. And then, you know, people are dying in the hospitals and he's partying and then he's jetting off to meet the Russian, blah, blah. Netflix would turn around and go, mate, it has to be believable, at least a little bit believable. Yeah. They just wouldn't believe it.
Yeah, they say when you analyse it about everything that's happened, and you think, oh, go, but, you know, loads of things have happened politically. And you go, no, actually, what has happened is in 2016, David Cameron got fed up with having to deal with the Eurosceptics in his party and threw them the bone that they've been asking for the decade prior, at least, if not longer.
Thinking it would be a
And said, fine, we're going...
Yeah.
Thinking it would be a whitewash. And I said at that time, I said, this is going to fail. This is going to massively, massively backfire. And I, the surprise I had the day after the Brexit vote was that it wasn't a greater victory for Brexit. Wow. That's what surprised me. Because in my mind, like, they don't seem to understand human beings. Is it just me? Or am I being far too simplistic? But they don't seem to understand what human beings are actually like. And when it comes to voting, and especially single-issue votes, like the referendum on Brexit that happened in 2016, a single-issue vote, people don't even bother. Do you remember they sent that pamphlet out? The government sent that pamphlet out for all, these are the reasons we want you to vote Remain.
Right.
Do you remember? Did you get that? Oh, we got. We all got these, like dual language pamphlets from the government. In Welsh and English, we got
them. Why weren't we ever part of the EU? Yeah, yeah.
Telling us why we should stay part of the EU and all the benefits of that. And the government says, we think you should vote for folk to Remain. I saw that and I go, no one is going to read this. No one is going to read it. All they're going to take away is that the government is telling me to vote with them for things to stay the same. And when you sit, and you go, oh, why did all these places up in, like, you know, northeast of England and Wales, these places that get loads of European funding, why did they why did they vote for Brexit? They're cutting off their nose to spite their face. No. You're missing the point. The point is these are all of the poor areas. These formerly, not even formerly, but quite significant industrial areas where large proportions of working class people work in industry, the last vestiges of industry that occur in this country. And for the previous 20 to 30 years, they have seen their wages go down. They have seen their environment get ruined. They've seen, their jobs go away to other countries with globalization and into Europe and all of this, that, and the other. And then you're giving them an option. Yeah, you're giving them the option to vote for things to stay the same in this crappy situation, or things to change. And no one knows. They didn't. People said, "Oh, they all, you know, they all were lied to, and they were said that, you know, that everything will get better." No, they were told that things would change. That's all they voted for. They voted that something would change, and something did change. Yeah. But it doesn't mean it was for the better, because, you know, because half the people were saying, oh, it'll be good. Half people said it was going to be bad, or whatever proportion you want to say. But they didn't care. They said, the government has not done anything for me, and now the government is telling me to vote the way they say.
Yeah, it's a very good point, Farbod. It's how they kind of, you know, it's easier to manipulate a desperate person, and it's easier to manipulate someone who's unhappy. And it's the same thing with the immigration thing just now. It's like, life sucks, mate, and just now it's tough, and you know, and the services you can't get, schools aren't as good, and you know, housing stuff and getting on the market stuff, and instead of going, well, you know, whose fault is that really? The government's obviously going to turn around and go, well, it's not ours, and let's blame someone else.
It's the Browns down the road.
It's them
exactly. It's so age old. I mean. I was talking about it. The numbers just don't add up. You know, you have people like that unbelievable, you know, King Primate Rectum that's on TV, Richard Tice, who, you know, was massively involved in the Leave campaign, was, I think, formerly a Conservative, but now is doing the Reform, I think, the Reform Party, which is just the BNP in another name. You know, he's out there going, we're getting 1,000 people invading our country from the south every day. And then you go, well, what is it? Because you're also saying that the total numbers are 40,000 people arriving in the last year. So 40,000 is not 1,000 people a day. And if it was 1,000 people a day, you're telling us we have over 350. You're having... but the argument isn't about logic. It isn't about rationality. The argument is about the reason your life is crap is not because of 12 years of Tory government. It's not about austerity. It's not about mismanagement. It's definitely not about Brexit, because we like that for whatever reason. It's because these brown people who are coming over and are desperate, who 80%+ of them get granted asylum when their asylum requests are eventually processed.
Genuine asylum.
You know, it's them that's doing it. It's them. That 40,000 people, that small town of people, are ruining everything for everyone else. And it's such a classic distraction technique. And it boils my blood that people even fall for it at all.
Yeah. And I think a lot of them kind of want to... They're so desperate to believe it. I think there's a significant amount, you know, like... And that's why disinformation works. Because if you're kind of sceptical and making up your mind about something, you're going to ask a few more questions. But I think in this situation, they just want it not to be their fault. It's not that they voted in, you know, an absolute a party that literally couldn't care less about the ordinary person. Or it's not that they got conned about Brexit. It has to be something external to them. And therefore, you hold it up for them and they'll grab it with both hands, even though it's BS and even though it doesn't make any sense on any metric. But I tell you, though, Farbod, it's working. I mean, I know Tory support just now is at the lowest it's been in a long time. And, you know, God help us, if we had an election now, they would be annihilated. But Sunak looks like he's going to draw a few more back, I think. He's taken it a wee bit more steady. I think he'll... And then they've got this racist base that they're going to hold on to. And did you see today, was it today, that Starmer tried to... I think he was genuinely... It was genuinely almost a political move where he was saying to them, well, there's some folk there that don't like immigration, there's a lot. Could we pull some of them over to Labour and kill the Tory party dead? Do you know what I mean? I think he just... I don't believe he's in any way... Not any more than any, you know, privileged white person is racist. I don't think he's an actual racist. Do you know what I mean? But I think he's
no. But he's. I think. But this is the problem. This is the problem I have with it. Is that, and this is the problem I have had with this whole Labour leadership at the moment. I don't think that Keir Starmer has the force of personality to drive home his point, and I think he is being advised really poorly, because actually the way he said it, exactly what you said, that it was deliberate, and it was deliberate to say we are too reliant on foreign NHS workers,
which he wasn't,
and you know, from overseas and all of the terms. No. But what he was, but there was a much better way. You know, no, he wasn't being critical of them. But it's the language you use is important, because you're absolutely right. It is that thing, like people. He's hoping that some people who agree, there are too many foreigners in the health service, will kind of like lurch to his way. But that isn't the moral high ground. That's a race to the bottom.
I think you're right. Bad advice, as you said, and you can almost see it in his demeanour that he's been getting this counselling about effectively just let the Tories keep making a mess of things and you're going to reap the rewards, and then, you know, sit on the fence. Even about the Brexit going into the single market thing, I think, you know, most people are now, most sensible economists are saying, well, actually we need a better relationship with Europe for economics. And he's not coming out with that because he wants to keep the Brexiteers on side and he wants to pull a bit of them. And I get it. I do get all that. But as you say, what we're looking for, what we're starving for just now, is someone with some moral values, someone who can lead the country morally. And it's, you know, you had Johnson in there, who's misogynistic, you know, corrupt, you know, lazy, going on holiday, you know, just not a nice person. And people see him and go, actually, that gives me permission to be like that. I can now be like that, because, and that's why they love him. They love those people that love him. They love him because that's how I would be if I had all that power. I'd be kind of living at large and, you know, totally enjoying myself. Yeah. And actually what you want is you want a statesman. You want someone that people can look up to and go, you know, there's someone that's done something good with their life, mm-hmm. and there's someone that's trying to lead us to a better path. And actually, they do not believe. I think the spin doctors and mm-hmm. those kind of crisis managers, campaign managers, they don't believe that people are genuinely like that. And I think that's where we're in trouble.
Yeah. Yeah. And I agree with you that we are starving for moral leadership, and the term moral leadership is a problematic one, because, you know, there are very unfortunate politicians who will put themselves forward as being very moral, ideal, shall we say? Because lots of fascists consider themselves to be upstanding and very moral people, you know, yes. God fearing and right and against all sorts of abominations. But I know what you mean in the sense that it's principled, I suppose, is the term. They want principled and confident. And I think that's the issue that I have with Starmer, I think, is that because of the way he seems to he goes too much with the stream, and he's too much trying to, like, I'm just gonna, it's too calculated. It's not genuine. When he talks, there is no fire in his belly.
Yeah, I get it.
And that's, people can get that. Whereas Boris Johnson has fire in his belly. When he talks, you can feel. Yeah. He needs a little bit of, or we need is someone with a bit of fire in their belly. You know who I think is great for this is that Mick Lynch. He has what I like. There's two things that you need to be an effective leader. You need to have fire in your belly, but your head in the freezer. He is cool. He doesn't get flustered. And he has got the fire in his belly, and he knows his stuff. That's probably the third important leg of the stool. You need to actually be on your brief.
Yeah, and he can see,
and that's why he
can see the straight path through, isn't it? When they're all hitting him with all these distractions and things, he won't engage it because he can see the path through. No. Which is very true. I mean, actually, Labour have quite a few good voices there, I think, that could see us through.
There's some great people in there.
I would like Starmer in, because he's boring and not boring, but he's vanilla and, you know, measured, and I want that.
Yeah,
man. I want a bit of boring, man. I let's get into it.
Yeah. I know. But that's it, exactly, isn't it? One of the things we're also looking for is that boring stability. Like, five PMs in 6 years, that is not stable government.
No.
And everything that's been happening since the 2016 has been the Tories, like, you know, like stabbing each other in the back, and everyone vying for their own, like, supremacy.
Honestly, you couldn't believe it. It was like being in a playground or something. It was like, I mean, who would imagine growing adults, apparently educated grown adults, would behave in that kind of way, that they would be all jumping for power grab. I mean, surely compose yourself, guys. Get yourself together, come out with a united front and you know, impress us. But just squabbling like little spotty, you know who summed it up the best still to this day, was Hugh Grant.
Who's that?
Hugh Grant. You know when he said the masturbating prefect? I thought that was just perfect, man. It was like proper spot on. It was like, these are just like fervent, still in school. They could easily still be in high school. They've not had any real lived experience. And the only ones that have seem to have just become extreme racists in some way. But the rest of them are just sweet ones. Do you know what I mean? Just fighting and arguing over, you know, who gets to have first pick and all that.
100%. And you see, the Gavin Williamson thing. Sir Gavin Williamson. That is just, it was him texting the chief whip, having a proper little meltdown. I should be going to the Queen's funeral. And you're like, mate, fuck off. Have some dignity. Ooh, you're a knight of the realm, for goodness sake. Yeah.
Jesus, a knight of the realm. Can you imagine? Can you imagine King Arthur? Yeah. Riding on a horse.
I mean, I know these things. Exactly. These things mean nothing. Of course they don't. Because, you know, bloody Lord Sugar, Alan Sugar's in the House of Lords. Do you know what I mean? And, well, we got the sons of former KGB agents in this House of Lords. So, you know, that's the whole shambles in and of itself. But the point is, you know, you have these, like, what used to be kind of the garlands of statehood and aristocracy, and I'm not for any of that nonsense, but there was at least the pretense that these people were somehow, you know, exactly above it all.
He's one that upholds the values that we all aspire to. But Gavin Williamson, was he not the one that walked in on
Sir
Boris?
Gavin. Was it him? I can't remember. Yeah, there was definitely something about one of the peerages. Or I know that Zach Goldsmith, there were some shenanigans regarding Goldsmith, but I think that might have been shenanigans involving... This is all alleged, by the way, if any lawyers are listening. This is entirely alleged, what we're saying. But I think there was some rumour that Zach Goldsmith was basically turfed out of government and put to the House of Lords because he was involved with the current wife of the... not the last Prime Minister, but the Prime Minister before.
Yes. We're losing track, man. We need to number them.
Exactly. You know. Oh, God.
Well, you look up... Then you look up Nicola Sturgeon. What do you think of Nicola Sturgeon, Farbod?
I have some mixed feelings about Nicola Sturgeon. Some. But I actually quite like her in that she gave this really, really good response about when she was being spoken to about trans rights and things and the science around it. And she gave a really nice... Whether you agree with it or not, it didn't matter. Again, it's that thing of having a little bit of integrity... It was considered, she knew what she was talking about, and she said, this is what I believe, this is what I like, and I'm putting it across in a nice way so you can understand my position. And I was like, do you know what? Fair play to you. I think that was excellent, and that's the kind of leadership that we have not been having south of Hadrian's Wall for quite some time. I think we do need a bit more of a... I think it would benefit the English system to get a bit more of that picked fire crossing Hadrian's Wall, that Pictish fire.
Maybe the SNP should run all the seats in England as well. Yeah, that might work, man.
My goodness, could you believe that?
I wonder.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And what we could do is... It would be a hard sell, but I think as England continues to just, like, eat itself, I think the sell might get a little bit easier. Do you know what I mean? Because, honestly, a few years ago, Yes Cymru, which is our equivalent of Vote Aye, it was a joke. I mean, no one really thought about it seriously. And even now, it's not particularly a serious thing, it is talked about. It's more... open, and the concept of a Welsh independent state, though probably not viable at the moment, it's at least entering the conversation. But like I said, to really sell it, I think if we like, oh, you know, let's get these Celtic
Cornwall
nations together.
Cornwall, not Celtic, as
yes,
well.
Yes, yes, 100%. We'll get Curnow involved. Yeah, yeah, what we'd do is we'd put, like, some explosives in the Tamar and just... and float it off. And it can be the island of Curnow. I mean, these are pipe dreams, but you know, you've got a dream, because if you didn't dream, you know, you need the hope. We need the hope, don't you? You need some sort of hope that there is a future for us. But I mean, not with the English.
For me,
I do apologize, English people listening.
No. I mean, I think that's one of the biggest reasons not for independence is you leave all the nice, you know, and you know, kind English folk,
yeah,
which are the vast majority, obviously, but stuck with this idiotic government. And we do buffer them. Do you know what I mean? I mean, Wales is mainly Labour. Scotland's mainly SNP. So Conservatives don't get seats.
Yeah.
And then if we leave, then obviously they get more chances.
Oh, no.
I do feel really bad about that. And it does make me think twice. But one thing that got me, this was really interesting for me anyway. So if you compare Scotland and England and how they're investing in the NHS, right, it's night and day, right?
Yeah.
And particularly the winter crisis, Scotland, they're given 600 mil, which is a massive amount for Scotland, just for winter. Just only for winter, yeah? Just sort out winter, here's some more, recruit staff, retain staff, blah, 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 blah. And then they said about the pay rise, and one of the ministers said, look, if we could borrow our own money, we would borrow to fund this crisis, to pay ourselves out of this NHS crisis, but we can't. We're stuck with whatever Westminster does. We're stuck with whatever comes our way. And that really resonated with me, man, because the priorities that they've had, you know, what my experience of the SNP and the Scottish government just now, the priorities they have are actually really good. Free prescriptions, free education, higher education, no hospital park. I mean, you couldn't even think about charging someone for hospital parking, you know. It would be, you know, an outrage. And I kind of get that sense that it's a socialist, you know, and a very people-first kind of thing. And it's kind of convincing me. And then the NHS thing. And then one of the, was it Lord Frost who said, and wrote in an article, that we need to go after devolution. We need to remove more of the power from devolution. And that to me scares the bejesus out of me, because we will, NHS in Scotland will survive. It will survive. It will be public. It will be tax based. It won't be insurance based. We will survive. NHS England, I'm totally on the fence whether it's going to survive or not. But they then threatening that, I think for me, that is the alarm bell for me, and what will make me seriously consider independence, I think.
Well, you know, that is a huge red flag. The re-centralisation of power. Because this devolution is a great idea, and it has worked to a greater or lesser extent for various things, but it's still dependent, exactly as you say, very dependent on what the government in Westminster decides is the share that is doled out to each of the devolved states, and they can take it away. But also, in a way, it absolves them of any responsibility, because they say, well, you're in charge. Like they say this to, where, you know, Welsh Labour all the time. Well, Welsh Labour are in charge of the NHS in Wales. And I go, yeah, you're in charge of the slice of the pie we've been given. But if the pie is not enough, which it isn't, Wales, out of all of the countries of the United Kingdom, Wales is the country that gets the least per capita when adjusted for the age and frailty of the population. We have by far the larger population of elderly, frail people compared to England, Scotland and Northern Ireland. And so we should be getting a proportionately higher amount for that population. But we don't. We actually come fourth. Even though we have the higher burden of disease in that chronic disease. And that's the reason. And the reason is they keep saying, well, you actually receive the most per capita. But that's like an absolute figure. And then they turn around and say, well, Welsh Labour in charge of the NHS. So you see, it's a very sly political way of saying every problem that occurs in the NHS is nothing to do with Westminster because it's devolved. But then when you actually, once you like scrape the surface and realise that it all depends on where what central government is giving, you realise that that aspect of devolution is a very sneaky and very cynical way of controlling the devolved states. And that in and of itself is an argument to decentralise further, not centralise more, decentralise further.
But
that is the only way to have government, you know, working for people in certain regions. But you cannot run
but the problem,
these countries from Westminster.
The problem is that the track record of this government of doing things you couldn't believe they could possibly do, you know, is set, you know, and lying their way to get there, and whatever back ways they can, channels they can do to get the desired outcome. I do not put it past them at all about trying to take more powers off Scotland, particularly, remember, because Sturgeon is standing up to them, and Scottish government are standing up to them and saying, you know, actually, and the Welsh government as well. I mean, that who's the head of the Welsh government just now? What's his name again?
Mark Drakeford.
Man, did he not rip that conservative Welsh Conservative?
Mark Drakeford, I mean, a lot of people in Wales don't like him, even those of the kind of socialist sort, because, you know, they think that he's a little bit of a wet drip. And I actually quite like him. I think he's a good guy. And you very rarely see him get crossed. But that time when, you know, he was having a go at the Tory leader, it was, you could see the rage in his, like, you come in here with his Welsh, you come here with pretending to be a bit of the Nye Bevan came out.
Yeah.
What planet are you on, man? You love to see it. I think one thing
everyone was feeling that way, and he articulated it so well. It was brilliant.
I know. And so Welsh as well. I loved how Welsh he got. And I think that's one thing that our banana republic at the moment is missing, is a proper parliamentary brawl. We haven't quite had that yet. I think that's, you know, see the other countries that you see, like the Ukrainian, the Greek,
Greece,
and some of the Middle Eastern countries, when they get all properly, like, you know, getting at each other's throats and punching each other, you know, all these like unfit men throwing terrible punches. That's one thing that so far we have missed. And, you know, as a fan of political entertainment, I feel a little bit aggrieved that we haven't quite reached that point. I want to see Keir Starmer's hair, you know, tussled. I want to see him with Sunak in an art, you know, in a headlock,
brilliant.
You know, giving him a proper noogie, you know, wedgying him. Like, oh, you like high trousers, do you? Take that. that is a trope in our parliamentary democracy that we have yet to see. And it is, I think it is a failure of the British of parliamentary democracy. Oh, we do definitely need to see a few parliamentary brawls, you know, because Prime Minister's questions is getting boring now. You know, they just keep getting up. Someone asks a reasonable question and the Prime Minister just doesn't bother answering it and just says something about, either says fastest vaccine rollout or something about energy caps or something about Jeremy Corbyn. And then next person answers and then they go, oh, well, you know, something about vaccine rollout, something about energy caps, something about Jeremy Corbyn. And it gets a bit nonsense. If, you know, some fists were flying, if someone like got up and grabbed that staff, you know, that and like conked someone over the head of it, at least there'll be something exciting. There'll be something worth tuning into BBC News at 10 for. Answer the bloody question. Oh God!
What do you think about Musk and Twitter? I've had some interesting conversations today about that.
Musky lad.
Planned thing, or do you think he's just big ego? Thinks he gets socially inept and he's just going to crash it.
I think he may have bitten off something that is far too big for him to chew. I think I think he's gone through life, especially in the last decade. Yeah, of course he would never admit. His ego will not allow him to admit he's made a mistake. And I don't know. I can see him properly flouncing off and trying to sell it off again and having to like take a huge loss on Twitter. Which, I mean, it will make me fucking shit myself laughing, because screw that guy, as far as I'm concerned. He put a bet. This is the kind of guy he is, right? He put out there, because he's a big loudmouth and he loves his sycophants, he put out there, he said, if someone comes to me, I'm not doing his accent because I can't. If someone comes to me and says that they've got a plan to end world hunger and it's properly costed, then, you know, I'll fund it. Yeah. So the guy from this guy from UNICEF said, "All right, here we are. This is the plan. It's like 6.8 billion. Yeah. Put loads of work into it. This is the plan. Fund it. And then nothing. And then a year later, he says he's going to buy Twitter for 44 billion. He wouldn't end world hunger for 6.8 billion, you know." And even if it wouldn't end world hunger, it's at least something to show that I'm actually serious. I am going to put my money where my mouth is, my big, fat, dumbass mouth. I'm going to put my money where my mouth is. And yeah, I'm going to call you bluff. You say that we can help with world hunger, I'm going to put 6.8 billion of my money into that. How about that, son? And I'll still be ridiculously rich. Instead of that, he's gone for 44 billion vanity project, which he tried to pull out of, let's not forget. Yes. He tried to pull out of, and because it was such a huge deal, lawyers got involved and said, you know what? It's going to cost you several billion to pay just the fees to get out of this. You may as well just buy it. And now he's sat on this £44 billion hell site with a whole bunch of people who, I must say, I am very impressed at all of the verified accounts who've been changing their names to Elon Musk, putting his avatar on and like tweeting some outrageous shit, which I found utterly hilarious.
He then comes out and says, anyone with anyone that's a Roddy on the account and is imitating anyone, you've got a lifetime ban.
I'm going to ban you. I'm going to ban you because that's what freedom of speech is all about.
Yeah, proper.
Oh my God. He's such a man child. And I think
the thing is, he could have been. Yeah. And he's already the richest guy on the planet. Twitter, as much as everybody kind of, it can become an echo chamber and it can come a little bit bitter and nasty. Or it can be very nasty on Twitter.
Yeah.
Actually, it's hugely influential. I mean, it's massively influential. Politicians, journalists,
it's
news can break.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? You can express yourself and you know, I think had he played his cards right, he probably still could, but he would be actually one of the most influential people on the planet. You know, not just the rich, but actually influential, you know?
Yeah. But this is the problem. This is the problem when you have a narcissist like him who thinks that... And the worst thing about it is not even him. It's those who empower him, the sycophants that go behind him and say, he invented space rockets and Tesla. And you're like, No, he didn't. He's a guy... He's got loads of money and he hires loads of really clever people and then he puts himself front and center as if it's him, as if it's his idea, as if he knows what he's talking about. Have you seen his tweets? The guy is Trump, but not as clever. I honestly don't think he's anywhere near as intelligent as people are giving him credit for. And my favorite thing is watching people realize this. There was this myth of Elon Musk. And now that myth is crumbling with every vain little, you know, little petty little tweet that he puts out about this, about how he keeps like, he thinks he's like trolling people by saying, oh yeah, well, you know, it's going to cost you $8 to keep that blue tick. I'm like, no, who cares? Who cares? If you're dumb enough to pay you $8 a month, you can have your blue tick. I don't care about that. What I care about is what nonsense you talk. What a low quality individual you clearly are.
The world would be too just if the richest man in the world was both intelligent and caring, you know, and well-rounded. You know, that would be, I think at this point in humanity's development, that would be asking way too much.
Maybe it's that, isn't it? Because it's that lie. It's the lie of meritocracy in the system that we have. Yeah. It's this idea that the richest are there because they are the best of what they do. Yeah. And I go, there's so much evidence to the contrary of that. There is so much evidence to the contrary of that. And it's this weird idea that if you're poor, it's because you're stupid and lazy. But if you're rich, you must work really hard and deserve every penny that you get. And that is such a fallacy. I can't understand why people can convince themselves of this. Bullshit.
And that's nurses getting grief now. I mean, can you believe it? Yeah. Of all the professions.
The greedy nurses. Those greedy nurses. Unbelievable. Can you believe? I think, to be honest, mate, I think the 2008 crash, do you know who it was? Nurses.
Yeah, must have been them. Yeah,
bloody, greedy, greedy. God.
I think they took a bank holiday and crashed the whole economy. It's literally like, I think being a nurse has to be one of the hardest jobs on the planet. I mean, and the only people that are saying lazy nurses and all that stuff are clearly people that have never worked with them or needed them. Do you know what I mean? It is a brutal job. And I think...
I know, and we got to the situation, you know, like in Leicester, they created that. There's a food bank in Leicester hospitals now for staff.
Yeah.
Did you hear about this?
I think it's a food bank for staff. Thousands of hospitals are opening food banks now. Yeah, yeah. It's unbelievable, man. It's unbelievable. Honestly.
Greedy nurses.
And the more time goes by, the more I'm convinced that they. They intentionally are tanking the NHS. They want it to fail, and they're bringing in private care to rescue it. You know, it's
yeah.
And you know what? I think they may even get away with it.
Well, the way they'll get away with it is going back to full circle to what we talked about at the beginning, which is the people. Because let's not forget, people always talk about the NHS. The NHS is so huge, this, that, and the other. Got all these buildings. 3/4 of the NHS money that is spent isn't spent on equipment or buildings or anything else. It's the people. Yep. The NHS is the staff. It's the workforce.
It's service.
And as we know, anyone who works... in the NHS, anyone who does any of the work in the NHS, it doesn't matter who you are, if you're a porter, if you're admin, if you're management, you know, the executives even, you know, it doesn't matter who you are, everyone knows that it works on the goodwill of and the compassion of the people who run it. And it's that compassion that has been targeted. It's that goodwill that is being drained and spent.
Very good.
And it's at that point, when that goes, and everyone has given up, their heart and their spirit and their soul is destroyed, that's when they'll say, here's the private equity firm that will hire you all back. You'll get double the wages. You'll get many perks that you never had. You'll get your parking paid for. You'll get all of this paid for. And, you know, your job will be fantastic. The only problem is the poor and the chronically ill are fucked.
Yes.
But who cares about them?
Shit.
That's what they'll turn around. That's how it's going to happen. Eventually, when everyone's spirit is broken, that is how it's going to come.
Aye.
Oh, dear. And on that light note, I think we need to start wrapping up.
Yes.
I've despite the way that we just ended that conversation, I've really enjoyed speaking to you again, Dan, and I'm really, really genuinely happy that you were my first repeating guest on this show. And if I'm honest, I would love it if we did this on a semi-regular basis, just so that we can chat.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, for catch up with stuff.
Enjoyed it too. I think maybe catch me at slightly less tired. I've had a 70-hour week, right? And then I went to that Byline Times TV thing. I don't know if you saw it, but went all the way down to London off my own expenses, by the way. I didn't get paid for it, right? And we're struggling at the moment. You know what it's like. And went all the way down there for 1 hour in the studio. It was actually fantastic. It was phenomenal. And then came all the way back and kept working. So it's been a long couple of weeks for me. But if we could do it on a regular, I will be coffeed up. I will be raring to go. And we will set some proper time. I love it, Farbod. I think it'd be great. It's always fascinating. I genuinely want your insights on things. I like hearing what you have to think because you have a really good way of thinking about stuff, and it's always good to broaden your mind a bit and stuff. So great, it'll be good fun.
It's life, Dan. You have the laughter, you have the anger, you have the tears. You know, this is what life's all about. You know, you're born and then you die, and the bit in between is called life. And that's what we're trying to experience together.
1 hour of life. Yeah. Good.
Dan, it's been my pleasure again, and I'm sure we will meet again on the podosphere.
Thanks for our pod.
You have been listening to the Dan and Bod Smile Time Happy Hour, produced by The Echo Chamber.